Many of us are aware of Rabindranath Tagore's views on nationalism. The Nobel Prize winning writer and poet talked about it in great details. For him, the humanity always came first before the country. So, in this podcast, I'm going to read some excerpts from his book on nationalism. It's a very short book and comprises of four parts: nationalism in the West, nationalism in Japan, nationalism in India, and the fourth part is the sunset of the century. I'm going to read a few paragraphs from the third part, which is nationalism in India. So here we go. I am not against one nation in particular, but against the general idea of all nations. What is the nation? It is the aspect of a whole people as an organized power. This organization incessantly keeps up the insistence of the population on becoming strong and efficient. But this strenuous effort after strength and efficiency drains man's energy from his higher nature, where he is self-sacrificing and creative. For thereby man's power of sacrifice is diverted from his ultimate object, which is moral, to the maintenance of this organization, which is mechanical. Yet in this he feels all the satisfaction of moral exaltation and therefore becomes supremely dangerous to humanity. He feels relieved of the urging of his conscience when he can transfer his responsibility to this machine, which is the creation of his intellect and not of his complete moral personality. By this device, the people which loves freedom perpetuates slavery in a large portion of the world with the comfortable feeling of pride of having done its duty. Men who are naturally just can be cruelly unjust both in their act and their thought, accompanied by a feeling what they are helping the world to receive its deserts. Men who are honest can blindly go on robbing others of their human rights for self-aggrandizement, all the while abusing the deprived for not deserving better treatment. We have seen in our everyday life, even small organizations of business and profession produce callousness of feeling in men who are naturally not bad, and we can well imagine what a moral havoc it is causing in a world where people are furiously organizing themselves for gaining wealth and power. Nationalism is the particular thing which for years has been at the bottom of India's troubles. And inasmuch as we have been ruled and dominated by a nation that is strictly political in its attitude, we have tried to develop within ourselves, despite our inheritance from the past, a belief in our eventual political destiny. There are different parties in India with different ideals. Some are struggling for political independence, others think that the time has not arrived for that, and yet believe that India should have the rights that the English colonies have. They wish to gain autonomy as far as possible. In the beginning of the history of political agitation in India, there was not the conflict between parties which there is today. At that time, there was a party known as the Indian Congress. It had no real program. They had a few grievances for redress by the authorities. They wanted larger representation in the council house and more freedom in municipal government. They wanted scraps of things, but they had no constructive ideal. Therefore, I was lacking in enthusiasm for their methods. It was my conviction that what India most needed was constructive work coming from within herself. In this work, we must take all risks and go on doing the duties which by right are ours, though in the teeth of persecution. Winning moral victory at every step by our failure and suffering. We must show those who are over us that we have in ourselves the strength of moral power, the power to suffer for truth. Where we have nothing to show, we have only to beg. It would be mischievous if the gifts we wish for were granted to us at once. And I have told my countrymen time and again to combine for the work of creating opportunities to give vent to our spirit of self-sacrifice and not for the purpose of begging. The party, however, lost power because the people soon came to realize how futile was the half policy adopted by them. The party split, and there arrived the extremists who advocated independence of action and discarded the begging method, the easiest method of relieving one's mind from his responsibility towards his country. Their ideals were based on Western history. They had no sympathy with the special problems of India. They did not recognize the patent fact that there were causes in our social organization which made then the Indian incapable of coping with the alien. What should we do if, for any reason, England was driven away? We should simply be victims for other nations. The same social weaknesses would prevail. The thing we in India have to think of is this: to remove those social customs and ideals which have generated a want of self-respect and a complete dependence on those above us. A state of affairs which has been brought about entirely by the domination in India of the caste system and the blind and lazy habit of relying upon the authority of traditions that are incongruous anachronisms in the present age. Once again, I draw your attention to the difficulties India has had to encounter and her struggle to overcome them. Her problem was the problem of the world in miniature. India is too vast in its area and too diverse in its races. It is many countries packed in one geographical receptacle. It is just the opposite of what Europe truly is, namely one country made into many. Thus, Europe in its culture and growth has had the advantage of the strength of the many as well as the strength of the one. India, on the contrary, being naturally many, yet one, has all along suffered from the looseness of its diversity and the feebleness of its unity. A true unity is like a round globe. It rolls on, carrying its burden easily. But diversity is a many-cornered thing which has to be dragged and pushed with all force. Be it said to the credit of India that this diversity was not her own creation. She has had to accept it as a fact from the beginning of her history. In America and Australia, Europe has simplified her problem by almost exterminating the original population. Even in the present age, this spirit of extermination is making itself manifest in the inhospitable shutting out of aliens by those who themselves were aliens in the lands they now occupy. But India tolerated differences of races from the first, and that spirit of toleration has acted all through her history. Her caste system is the outcome of this spirit of toleration. For India has all along been trying experiments in evolving a social unity within which all the different peoples could be held together while fully enjoying the freedom of maintaining their own differences. The tie has been as loose as possible, yet as close as the circumstances permitted. This has produced something like a United States of a social federation, whose common name is Hinduism. India had felt that diversity of races, there must be and should be, whatever may be its drawback, and you can never coerce nature into your narrow limits of convenience without paying one day very dearly for it. In this, India was right. But what she failed to realize was that in human beings, differences are not like the physical barriers of mountains fixed forever. They are fluid with life's flow. They are changing their courses and their shapes and volume. Therefore, in her caste regulations, India recognized differences, but not the mutability, which is the law of life. In trying to avoid collisions, she set up boundaries of immovable walls, thus giving to her numerous races the negative benefit of peace and order, but not the positive opportunity of expansion and movement. She accepted nature where it produces diversity, but ignored it where it uses that diversity for its world game of infinite permutations and combinations. She treated life in all truth where it is manifold, but insulted it wherever it is moving. Therefore, life departed from her social system, and in its place, she is worshipping with all ceremony the magnificent cage of countless compartments that she has manufactured. The same thing happened where she tried to ward off the collisions of trade interests. She associated different trades and professions with different castes. This had the effect of allaying for good the interminable jealousy and hatred of competition, the competition which breeds cruelty and makes the atmosphere thick with lies and deception. In this also, India laid all her emphasis upon the law of heredity, ignoring the law of mutation, and thus gradually reduced arts into crafts and genius into skill. However, what Western observers fail to discern is that in her caste system, India, in all seriousness, accepted her responsibility to solve the race problem in such a manner as to avoid all friction, and yet to afford each race freedom within its boundaries. Let us admit, India has not in this achieved a full measure of success. But this you must also concede, that the West, being more favorably situated as to homogeneity of races, has never given her attention to this problem. And whenever confronted with it, she has tried to make it easy by ignoring it altogether. And this is the source of her anti-Asiatic agitations for depriving aliens of their rights to earn their honest living on these shores. In most of your colonies, you only admit them on condition of their accepting the menial positions of hewers of wood and drawers of water. Either you shut your doors against the aliens or reduce them into slavery. And this is your solution of the problem of race conflict. Whatever may be its merits, you will have to admit that it does not spring from the higher impulses of civilization, but from the lower passions of greed and hatred. You say this is human nature, and India also thought she knew human nature when she strongly barricaded her race distinctions by the fixed barriers of social gradations. But we have found out to our cost that human nature is not what it seems, but what it is in truth, which is in its infinite possibilities. And when we in our blindness insult humanity for its ragged appearance, it sheds its disguise to disclose to us that we have insulted our God. The degradation which we cast upon others in our pride or self-interest degrades our own humanity. And this is the punishment which is most terrible, because we do not detect it till it is too late.